Welcome to the full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at at 11:35 a.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is November 3rd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, when we look at the market today, it was really all about Apple. Today was the first day on which the iPhone X went on sale, and there were long lines, and there's already a secondary market for the phone in Hong Kong. So there's a great deal of optimism that it is going to be a good seller. And when we look at the Apple chart on not simply a daily basis but a weekly basis, we can see that it had certainly the pace of the advance had moderated over the last while. And what we've also seen in the at peaks in 2012 and in 2015 was that it lost consistency at the penultimate peak. So this emphatic breakout this week is a slapdown to that potential that it was forming a top, and it is reasserting the medium-term uptrend at present. Its market cap crossed the $900 billion level in here today. So when we can look at Apple, I think it is no exaggeration to say that what's good for Apple is good for Wall Street. And we used to be able to say that about GE. That's no longer the case. General Electric is pretty much doing the opposite. Now, it is back in an area of potential support, but it is certainly not a share that is doing particularly well in this environment. And that also helps to, I think, ram home the point that what we have is a polarized market. There are very clear winners and losers, and it is large cap technology that is leading this market higher. It isn't simply that Amazon is breaking on the upside, but we've already seen that Amazon did the same thing last week, and it has tacked on $100 since it broke above 1,000, and it was up an additional 17 in here today. Then Google had also been consolidating in the region of 1,000, and it has pulled away from that $1,000 level as well. It hasn't been quite as explosive as Amazon, but it is breaking on the upside nonetheless. Facebook is a very similar story, that it has just broken out of its most recent range. Now, what we can see in terms of the consistency of Facebook's trend is that every time it becomes somewhat overextended, it has pulled back, and it is somewhat overextended at present. So there is the potential for some pause and consolidation, but in the absence of a clear and sustained move below the trend mean, we would have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Then if we look at Microsoft, for example, Microsoft adopted a subscription model a few years ago, and since then the share has done nothing but rise. But it is accelerating at the present moment. The pace of the advance has certainly picked up. When we look at the Dow Jones, then it has also picked up. Now, the Dow spent most of this week doing not much of anything at all, and but the pace of its advance has picked up. It is due some pause in consolidation, and so far it is getting some pause in consolidation. This range, such as it is, has been relatively similar to the one that we saw back in September. But what we can also see is that the amplitude of the ranges is declining. When the market goes sideways, it goes sideways in a very narrow band. That's true of the Dow. It's also true of the S&P 500, which was at a new closing high in here today. And the range that we've had, even though there has still been an upward bias, we have had occasional little stabs on the downside. And I really do want to emphasize that word, little stab on the downside. The amplitude of the ranges is becoming really quite narrow, and part of the reason for that is because of the very low levels that we have on the VIX index. It's down now to maybe not quite as low as we saw back in July, but on a closing basis, the chances are that the index is going to close at a new low. And that is really quite profound. That volatility is so very low that the most recent pop on the upside that we saw in the last week of October was very short-lived, and it didn't go quite as high as any of those little pops on the upside in volatility that we saw in April, May, June, or August. And what it is being driven by, this incredibly low volatility reading, is the fact that you have quantitative strategies that are approaching the volatility metric as a way of hedging. So by being long on one hand, they can be short the VIX. And by shorting the VIX, what they're doing, in fact, is selling time. The vast majority of options expire worthless. So by shorting options on the VIX, what you are in fact doing is selling time. And that is a bet that the options will expire worthless. And that works most of the time. Of course, eventually it will stop working, and then we will have really quite a profound shakeout from these highly leveraged strategies. And then on the other hand, you have risk parity strategies, which are moving into the equity market and also have simultaneous long positions in bonds, so that when one falls, the other one will rise, and vice versa. And that has worked because we are still in this environment where we have really quite low interest rates. The market has taken, I think, taken heart this week from the moderate pick that President Trump has made for the head of the Fed, that rather than reappoint Janet Yellen, he has taken a version or taken a candidate who is likely to pursue a very similar strategy. So that would suggest that the pace of interest rate hikes is going to be relatively, I think, gradual. That they're going to be really quite cautious about moving to take a lot of the liquidity out of the market. The Fed is beginning to move towards removing some of the size, or reducing some of the size of its balance sheet, and that does have the potential to become something of an issue in future, but not right now. And I think that that is perhaps the most important point, that when people are looking at these markets, that there isn't a great deal of evidence that we have imminent evidence of big pullbacks. This remains a demand-dominated environment. And certainly we know that if we see not just one central bank, but a number beginning to reduce the size of their respective balance sheets, then that is going to have an impact, and most particularly on those leverage strategies, or on those that depend on not only interest, low interest rates, but abundant access to liquidity for their profitability. Those are what we can anticipate will be the issues in future. In the meantime, what we can see abundant evidence of is that there is polarity in the market between the clear winners and losers. So, for example, Amazon is moving into pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical sales. It's moving into selling sporting gear under its own brand, and then also just textiles and clothing more generally. And obviously, that is then putting pressure on a number of the other brands. So, when we look at what it is that is most likely to be disrupted, it's generally speaking tends to be reasonably lower valued items. And one of the reasons that the luxury goods sector is back on a recovery trajectory is because it's not particularly easy to sell them online. One of the great issues that online businesses have is with returns and with people saying they never got the item. And if you decide to sell on Amazon, then as a seller, you simply have to take that risk and put it down to a loss similar to what people would have considered the loss from shoplifting. And that's I think that's a bearable cost when the value of the item is comparatively low. But when you're talking about items that are thousands of dollars in value, whether that be online diamonds or luxury goods like shoes and bags, then there is an incentive to do so in person. They so far have demurred from selling online in many respects because of the high value nature of the goods. And that is helping to continue to drive foot traffic towards their stores, and they are of course leveraged to global growth. Then you have, on the other side of the equation, you have companies that are failing to rally to the online environment. Under Armour is a good example of that. The share is collapsing from a peak over $50 back in 2015. It's currently trading around 11, and this is a clearly defined downtrend. But of course, they are not simply being challenged by their own failure in developing an online strategy, but also in the decline of the kinds of retail stores that they would have been selling their goods from, like Macy's, which is also in a clearly defined downtrend. What this helps to really point out is again this polarity that we're getting in the markets. There are clear winners and losers, and the technology sector is outperforming here because while brick and mortar, and most particularly the brick and mortar sector that is in the middle, is really taking a hit. That is exactly the demographic that Amazon and its ilk are going after. They are less of a threat to the very high value items, and they're less of a threat to very low value items. Ross Stores, for example, is appealing to a demographic that probably doesn't pay the $100 for an Amazon Prime account. And that is probably also the case for companies like eBay. And this is, I think, I think a demonstration of the striation that we're getting in various demographics. And that is also why so many companies are now starting to move towards a subscription model, that they are delineating demographics by cash flow. They're, rather than looking at the individual, they're looking at the individual cash flows that various demographics represent. And one of the things that was quite clear from the testimony that both Google and Facebook gave before Congress in here this week was that these digital ads work. That is perhaps the biggest takeaway. It's a pretty it, when we see these stories of mass killings, and the details are grisly, but what it also does is it's almost like an advertisement for the manufacturers of these weapons, because it is a graphic representation of the fact that they do the job that they're designed to do. And while the comparison is certainly not a not particularly tasteful, we can see the same thing with Google and Facebook, that they were the vehicles used by the Russian government to try and influence the electorate, and we have evidence, at least some evidence, that anecdotal, however you want to describe it, that it was in fact successful. So that is good news from the perspective of companies like Google and Facebook, that they can offer very clear and access to demographics and on a very customizable basis for advertisers. And I think that is the future, that when we look at the pace with which technological innovation is being adopted by these very well endowed companies in terms of their capital structure, that Amazon can, or Google or Facebook can engage in any business practice they wish, because that there is no barrier to entry when you have such a large kitty to support any venture. Then they are moving into automation. They're moving into the automation of the clothing industry. That is something that is could have profound effects in terms of not only the cost, but also the supply of clothing, that we could have the entire global logistics sector disrupted if the pace of globalization starts to slow down. It also means that we need to continue to see trends of continued improving governance in the emerging markets, so that they can develop their own domestic markets, because the export to the world without a domestic demand growth model is unlikely to work in the next 20 years the same way it did in the last 20 because of reshoring, because of these advances in the manufacturing process, that it is possible to use robots to manufacture a denim shirt for 33 cents in Arkansas and to have the same shirt manufactured in Bangladesh takes about 22 cents, whereas previously it would have cost $7.50 to have it manufactured in the USA. And so that's a profound change. That isn't something that is simply an accounting error. And when you start then to begin to consider what the cost of import, of transportation, and of taxes are, then there is a viable argument for why you can manufacture again in the USA. So this is still an evolving trend, but it is only likely to continue to advance, and not least as the regulatory environment and the political environment becomes somewhat ambivalent to globalization and is likely to continue to lend assistance to domestic manufacturing in order to boost employment. When we think about where are we in terms of this broad cycle, then what we're starting to see, particularly in the USA, is a I think a turn towards pro-cyclical policies that we're already at full employment, that economic growth has been modest, but it has been positive for years already, and that we're at full employment, that labor force participation rates are improving, having trended lower for much of the last 7 or 8 years, and now we're starting to move into a period of time where interest rates might be rising, but very, very slowly, and the federal government is planning to run a $1.5 trillion deficit over the next decade. So we are in I think a liquidity fueled bull market is certainly one way of considering it. The most important thing that the S&P 500 has done in the last decade is break up out of this 13-year range, and it has stormed ahead over the last couple of years. It has been really very consistent. This advance over the last year has been much more consistent than that move that we saw in 2012 through 2014, and that itself was a very consistent advance. So it is due a pullback if the advance from November were to remain consistent. If it doesn't get it, then we would have to consider that this market is getting increasingly frothy, and that eventually we are going to move into a medium-term correction, which could last for anything from 3 to 6 months, all the way up to a year and a half. That's exactly what we saw back in the end of 2014 through to the beginning of 2016. It is more than possible within the context of an overall secular bull market to get periods of time where the market doesn't do much of anything for really quite some time. And the fact that we have had such an incredible advance suggests that there is the potential here that the market accelerate. I think that that is something that we really do have to consider as a realistic possibility, that by and large, what we anticipate is that as a market becomes, as a trend becomes progressively more well developed, that it becomes more consistent as more people get the message and more money pours into the market, and that the trend becomes self-feeding. And considering that the market has already been rallying for just about 8 years, then we know this isn't particularly early. So then there is the potential that we could get a mid cycle blowout, that we get an acceleration higher, then we go into a period of ranging that could last a couple of years before the next big breakout occurs within the context of a secular bull market. So I think the way to characterize all of this is that we are in the latter stages of a medium-term cyclical bull and still in the relatively early stages of a secular bull market. And one way to look at that is that the the Dow gold ratio, which if we look at it over the last 100 years, it gives us these really quite impressive peaks and equally impressive troughs. And now we have had this impressive advance since about 2011, when gold peaked around $1,900, and the Dow Jones has outperformed it in really quite robust form since then. In fact, if you look at what the actual numbers are, that the low down there in 2011 was around, let's say, 6.5, and it is currently around 18.5. So it's not far off that the Dow Jones has gone up over 200% relative to the gold price in the last 6 years. And if history is any guide, that it's not going to go up in a straight line. We've already seen one significant pullback, but that it will go up and make a new high before this secular bull market has run its course. That means that the price of the Dow Jones could be at more than 45 times the price of gold before this secular bull market in stocks ends. And that would be a rather incredible advance. What it would also suggest is that from current levels, the Dow Jones could double relative to the gold price in that time. So when I make the draw the conclusion that we're still in the relatively early stages of a secular bull market, that is the foundation for that hypothesis. That when we think about where we are, and we're in a clear blue sky moving to new all-time highs, then we know that secular bull markets in equities last a long time, and that they can persist for much longer than a lot of people anticipate. And then they are eventually killed off by rising interest rates. And we are nowhere near the kind of interest rates that would kill off a secular bull market right now. The 10-year US Treasury is at 2.34%. It has failed to sustain the move above 2.4% 2 weeks ago, and it remains within this base formation, which has been developing now for nearly 5 years. But this is one of the most persistent and lengthy bear markets in yield, or bull markets in bond prices, in history. And when we look at what is going on out there, where the cost of living has increased, we're seeing this rise in what some people call populism, others call reactionism, some call or others call it nationalism, some call it xenophobia, separatism, but what I define it as reactionism. It's a broad spectrum reaction against the status quo. And it is most particularly a reaction against falling standards of living. And those falling standards of living can be laid squarely at the fact that savers have been robbed by extremely low interest rates and haven't benefited from asset price inflation. The people who have benefit are those that have assets, and that represents the minority. In the UK, it's only about a quarter of households today have a mortgage. Now, that doesn't mean that the vast majority of people suddenly own their houses, but rather that there is a significant demographic that don't own a house, that they're all renting, and that their potential to ever own a house at today's income levels and today's house prices are not particularly enthusiastic or optimistic. So when you have that kind of situation in a society which has become accustomed to home ownership as being the first leg on the property market, has been the ambition of people for generations, then that is creating a reaction. That I posted a chart last week, in, or at least showed it in the audio or in the video, of just how wide the gap between rich and poor is. And of course, London is a massively distorting effect. But that's really only the UK. That we're seeing these kinds of trends evolve just about everywhere, and it's creating this reactionism. And we know also what the reaction of politicians is to that, and it is to give the people what they want. What people want is more money, so they get tax cuts. That's exactly what's being pushed through in the US right now. And these kinds of political moves, these kinds of evolutions are, I think, a real-time example of the master-slave dialectic. Because when we have a trend and we have this very long experience of a disinflationary environment, then it is very easy to conclude that this is how it will always be. But that is just not how markets work. It is exactly when everyone thinks that the trend will persist indefinitely is when it is at its greatest risk of reversing. And we know that technology has a deflationary effect. But what we have seen massive inflation is in these sectors that are not particularly affected by the deflationary forces of technology, and most particularly in healthcare or in education, and where we have seen costs rising. And what we've also seen is the benefits that that unions have negotiated, most particularly for their government employees, are rather profound relative to what is available for private sector employees. So these are major challenges, and what we know is that if the money is not there to pay for unfunded liabilities, then they won't be paid, or that the liabilities will be restructured in such a way that they can be paid, or most particularly, and the most often used solution is to inflate the problems. And that is certainly what we have potential we're potentially now at the dawn of. It's too early yet to confirm that that is yet the case. But what we are starting to see is that Japan is breaking out. And I think that that is one of the most profound changes that we've seen in a very long time. An argument that I've made in successive videos is that Japan tried and failed to foment inflation all the way through the 1990s and 2000. And part of the reason it failed was because maybe it wasn't adventurous enough in terms of its loose monetary policy and fiscal policy. That's certainly one potential outcome. Or that another reason that is often preferred is that with the balance sheet recession that it had, that it takes decades to unwind that kind of leverage, and that also bears merit. But I think that there is another way of interpreting it that it does need to be considered, and it is, could they possibly have succeeded when the global environment was in one of the greatest periods of disinflation in history? So the fact that Japan's inflation mission now appears to be working, then that is something that we really that should give pause to anyone who thinks that the deflationary environment that has been in evidence in bond pricing for the last 10 years in particular is going to persist indefinitely. Now we have a base formation. That base formation has not been completed on those government bond yields, but if it's a base formation, it will be completed eventually. And the fact that the topics has broken out and is at new highs, at new highs that haven't been seen since 1992, that's, I think, one of the most profound changes in markets that we've had in at least the last 5 or 6 years. If Japan is breaking out, and the topics might have been the laggard, the Nikkei has broken out in emphatic form, and it's been up about 100 points a day for the last 6 weeks, and it cleared the 22,000 point level this week, but it has now broken emphatically higher, and it is now, in fact, challenging that very brief high that we had back in 1996. So there is the potential that we might get some pause in consolidation because it is going up so quickly. But as long as it is holding the move above 20,000, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And the entire market has been led higher by the small caps. And the second section index has been a lead indicator for outperformance by Japanese equities for really quite some time. And it has rallied right up to the 7,000 level, which is 2,000 points more than the peak that it had back in 2006. It paused at 5,000, it paused at 6,000, so there is the potential that it is going to pause at 7,000. And I think that in the absence of a clear and sustained move above that level, then we would have to give that perhaps the benefit of the doubt. So I don't think that there is necessarily a particular need to rush into Japan this week, but that any form of pullback is likely to represent a buying opportunity for the medium term. And if that is indeed the case, then we probably should just go back and look at what it is the bond markets have been doing. The Merrill Lynch total return on Treasury futures has been going up in a consistent manner since its origin in 1982. But this trend has lost momentum. It has been going sideways more than trending higher for the last 3 years. And it isn't quite below the 200-day moving average, but it is certainly testing it in here. A sustained move below this level would confirm more than a short-term bearish bias. If it were to break below the lows that we saw at the beginning of this year, around 2050, then we would be talking about a completing Type 3 top formation or a completing head and shoulders. And that cannot be ruled out. If we're moving into a more inflationary environment, then the extent to which central banks are willing to raise interest rates is going to be a big question, because they have a phenomenal amount of debt outstanding. And the way that you can handle that debt is to inflate it away. And that gives them an incentive to be somewhat behind the curve. Excuse me. Sneezing. Sorry about that. And I didn't mute it fast enough. But when we think about what the potential is, that central banks, the last thing that they want to do is to endanger the expansions in economies that we have had. So they're very slow to raise interest rates, and that's despite the fact that the Bank of England reversed its interest rate cut from directly after Brexit this week, and that the Fed is looking to raise interest rates again by the end of this year. But they're still doing it very, very cautiously, and the ECB is nowhere near raising interest rates, neither is Japan, and China is still trying to tailor its monetary policy and fiscal policy to try and keep stimulating the economy while taking some of the leverage out of the system. And the net effect is that it's pretty neutral. Now, when we look at the total quantity of money that is out there from those major central banks, then it was down 51 billion this week, but it's still at 19.3 trillion. And when we look at the chart on that long-term basis, it's pretty much going sideways. This is still a reasonably consistent advance, and it has paused from time to time. If it were trending lower, that would be a different story. If this were starting to trend lower, then we would be robbed of one of the most powerful catalysts for additional upside in asset prices, and that would represent a headwind for stock markets. But it is not trending lower. There is no evidence of that just yet. There is ample potential that other central banks will take up the slack from the US, reducing the size of its balance sheet. when we look at the main drivers behind the advance, it is improving governance in some of the world's largest populations. And India stands out for a particular study here because the Nifty has cleared the 10,000 level and it is improving upon that performance and breaking away from its most recent range. And it is being joined now by the Bombay Banks Index. And generally speaking, the Bombay Banks Index has led on the upside. And the fact that it has not led on this occasion is and but is now starting to play catch up is a testament to just how large the problem for the banks, the non-performing loans were, and how much of a change it represents that the recapitalization of the state-owned banks has now been achieved. This is really quite, again, another profound change in terms of governance that we have. We really have lots of examples at this stage where governance is improving in India, and that it is a reform-minded and growth-oriented administration that is willing to do what it takes to improve the standards of living of what are hundreds of millions of new consumers. And when we look at some of the other major population centers, then Indonesia has also broken up and away from this rather volatile and lengthy trading range. The Philippines, with some of the most compelling demographics in the region, it does look like it is consolidating now following that breakout. But as long as it is holding the breakout, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Malaysia is the country in the region that has got some of the greatest challenges with demographics. So it is the one outlier that is not at a new high and really does now need to find support in the region of the trend mean, despite the fact that you have this uptick in geopolitical tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The KOSPI continues to extend this breakout from what was really quite a lengthy range. What I also find particularly interesting is that Taiwan led the breakout in Japan by a few months, and it also continues to extend this break above the psychological 10,000 level. So when you start to string all of this performance together, and we can see that Europe is also finally starting to break above this 400 level. It just about cleared it in here today, and we'll have to hold it, of course, next week. But Europe has been ranging below that 400 level for nearly 3 years and is now just in the process of breaking higher. And if we look at all of those, that we have not only synchronized global economic expansion, but we have a synchronized global expansion in asset values, most particularly in the stock market. And they are benefiting from this Goldilocks period where growth is picking up, but interest rates have not yet become a headwind. Now, we know that eventually interest rates will become a headwind. We know that that corporate spreads, and most particularly high yield spreads, will become a problem at some point in the future, but they're not a problem now. And as long as that remains the case, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. The yield curve is still positive. It's at about 72 basis points. It is trending lower. But based on the trajectory of the trend, such as it has been since 2011, then it could take another year before we move into negative territory. If that's the case, then an inverted yield curve is a lead indicator for recessions with a lead time of anything from 6 months to 18 months. So then we can start to think about when the next recession will be. It could be anything from a year from now to 3 years from now. If that's the case, then there is the potential that asset prices are going to improve quite substantially between now and then. And then that also helps to support the potential that we could have an acceleration from here. And I think that the most important thing to bear in mind is that all of the bearish arguments that have been proposed over the last month, and most particularly around the time of the anniversary of the 1987 crash, well, those will be important points to remember a year from now, or even 2 years from now, when nobody wants to talk about them anymore. What we know from our study of markets and of psychology over the long period of time is that it's usually when people are talking about all the risks, it's more telling us that they're not long rather than what the particular risk is, whether it's imminent or not. It's when people are lionizing the bulls, when they are thinking that they have never made money so quickly and that things are going to remain like this forever. That's usually when things are pretty close to a top. Now, when we look at corporate profits, the last time this data was updated was on the 30th of June, and the next update will be on the 29th of November. I have a feeling that that this isn't particularly reliable, because I remember that the last time I saw that it was sometime in late November, excuse me, late October, and they've just moved it out a month. But we know that earnings have been positive over the last quarter, so there is the potential that corporate profits could break upwards, and that would ameliorate some of the asset of the expansion in valuations that we've had in a number of stock markets. When we think about what this chart tells us, it's usually that corporate profits deteriorate ahead of a recession. There is the potential that this, well, we know, for example, that the fact that these corporate profits have pretty much gone sideways for the last 3 years has contributed to valuation expansion. If corporate profits begin to trend higher again, then that will contribute to a valuation contraction, or at least stability, because prices will continue to rally. And it means that that could be additional fuel for an additional rally. Now, when we think about this Goldilocks period, where we have synchronized global economic expansion coupled with a reluctance of central banks to raise interest rates aggressively, then it is cyclical shares tend to do best, and those particularly that are leveraged to global growth. So the mining sector is certainly doing better, and it is being led higher by the electric car sector, or the battery sector most particularly, because there is 8 times more copper in a lithium-ion battery than lithium, and that is helping to drive investment into additional supply. Then there is also nickel in an electric vehicle, and nickel just this week broke higher. We're starting to see the argument for the growth in the resources sector coalescing around a major supply and elasticity theme, and then also that they're benefiting from continued growth in the global economy. So that is helping inventories to decline, and we have been out of an investment cycle in supply for much of the last 6 years. So it's going to take time to bring some of that supply to market. And the oil price this week was able to sustain a move above 60 and was up $1.50 in here today, so it's extending its breakout. So we know that additional supply is going to become economic around these levels, but it's going to take a few months to get it there. So that means that in the period between when new supply is brought to market, there is potential for asset prices to advance from here. So if we look at the energy sector, and I'm just going to look at the US one just to capture the majority of the majors, then it is now firming from the region of the trend mean, and it is still a fraction of where it was back at the peak in 2014. So there is potential for the energy sector to start to perform once more as well. Then the the healthcare sector, but most particularly the biotechnology sector, had some of the wind knocked out of it with Celgene's miss in earnings last week, but it has firmed from the region of the trend mean. And as long as it is holding that progression of higher reaction lows, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside there as well. So if we then look at the banking sector, which is also leveraged to growth, then the S&P 500 banks has broken up and out of what was a range for almost all of this year and continues to advance. And if that's one side of the spectrum, then we should also take a look at the European sector, which is rallying within the context of an almost decade-long range. So then I've also already looked at the luxury goods sector, and all of these are cyclical sectors that we expect to do well in the latter stages of a medium-term expansion, and they're doing exactly that, which confirms that we're in the latter stages. But then we also have the clear outperformers in the technology sector in particular. And now we're also seeing catch up by Europe and the emerging markets. So this remains a really very benign environment. What we have is a short-term overbought condition on majority of markets. It would be quite healthy if we get a pause in consolidation. And there is the potential that that might not happen and that we move into an accelerating period. And that, in fact, the fact that volatility did not rally any more than very modestly last week would suggest that that trend of money flowing in and buying the dips and buying very small dips is accelerating, and that will contribute to additional upside, and eventually it will likely also contribute to a much swifter pullback, but we're just not there yet. This is certainly a time to I think to watch the market and to think about trailing stops, because I think on the balance of probabilities, the most likely scenario is that we're going to have an acceleration higher. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.